Hello and welcome to The Late Debate with me, Audrey Carvel. Coming up, full employment by 2020, the government's ambitious aim.
Economic recovery means having a job, being able to see your grandchildren at Christmas in person rather than Skype.
And how do you change this attitude?
You did an interview in which you said, it's not the worst thing to slap a woman now and then. As I remember, you said you don't do it with a clenched fist, it's better to do it with an open hand.
I haven't changed my opinion.
First, the news from Angus McGreena.
Good evening. The incoming president of the Irish Farmers Association has used his first address to criticise retailers who have reduced the price of vegetables in the run-up to Christmas. Eddie Downey from Slane in County Meath was elected the 14th president of the IFA this evening. He defeated Ger Bergen from County Laois and will take up his position next month. Mr Downey said the income of farmers must be protected and they were being damaged by retailers who had cut vegetable prices.
You can't cheapen food like this. It just has to stop. It's simply, it's obscene to say that we can operate on the basis just to get footfall across the doors of multiples, that they will cut the margins or cut the profits completely out of vulnerable farm families coming up to Christmas.
Irish fishermen operating in the Celtic Sea face significant cuts to their allowable catch next year. The outcome follows talks involving EU fisheries ministers in Brussels. Haddock and cod quotas in the Celtic Sea were reduced by a third. Minister Simon Coveney said the original European Commission proposal was for a 75% reduction. A man has been taken to hospital after he was stabbed during a raid in Waterford City. It's understood at least four people were involved in the robbery at a filling station on the Park Road at around 7 o'clock this evening. The injured man is believed to have been a customer. He's said to be in a serious condition in hospital. Four people were arrested shortly after the raid by Gardaí. The humanitarian aid organisation Médecins Sans Frontières has said that more than 100 people have been killed and dozens injured following 3 days of airstrikes on the Syrian city of Aleppo. Opposition activists said barrels containing explosives were being dropped from helicopters by government forces. MSF said the casualties had overwhelmed the overstretched and damaged hospitals in Aleppo. And the weather forecast, windy tonight with heavy rain. The rain will become lighter and more scattered later in the night and winds will moderate. Lowest temperatures of 3 to 6 degrees. And there's a warning of southerly gales or strong gales tonight on all coastal waters and on the Irish Sea. Mostly dry and bright at first tomorrow, but wet and windy weather will spread from the west during the afternoon. That's all for now. Audrey.
Angus, thank you very much indeed. You're very welcome back to the programme. And coming up later, as Christmas draws closer, many people looking forward to the celebrations, but some people dread it for various reasons, one being the excessive consumption of alcohol and the violence which sometimes follows. The most recent figures show that almost 8,000 women and over 3,000 children sought refuge from domestic violence in 2011. Later, we'll be discussing violence against women in the home and in wider society. First, though, to the government's economic plan, a strategy for growth, which was announced this evening. It's Enda Kenny's post-bailout economic strategy, and it aims to return the country to the employment levels of the Celtic Tiger years, restoring the 330,000 jobs lost during the past 5 years. It predicts that unemployment will fall from 13.5% now to 8% within 6 years. It aims to have full employment by 2020. Enda Kenny said that 2014 would be the year for jobs. And according to the plan, growth will exceed 3% between 2017 and 2020. So is all or any of this aspirational or realistic? With me in studio tonight, Labour Senator Susan O'Keefe, Fianna Fáil spokesman on jobs, enterprise and innovation, Dara Cailleary, and financial analyst and Daily Mail columnist, Cormac Lucy. You're all very welcome indeed. Susan O'Keefe, reading through the plan, it's full of generalised statements. It's full of repetition of what you've already done, the policies that you're following. There's lots of speculation about growth between now and 2020. Is it a lot of hype about very little?
I think this is a serious statement of intent. I think it's the government coming out saying we have got out of the bailout is over. It's a post-Troika era. And that only happened on Sunday. And this is Tuesday. And if you like, here is our plan that says, yes, some of this is aspirational because you always must aspire in politics, in anything, in business, to do better, to create jobs, to create security, to promote equality. That is aspirational and that's correct that that be there. But I think on top of that, it's also saying very simply and very clearly, you know, we've had 16 months of growth, of jobs, And that's a very good thing, given what's gone on in the previous 3 or 4 years. We want that to continue, and we want the policies put in place and continue to be put in place in order to create more jobs. And that really is the bottom line of this 60-odd pages of effort.
But there's very little, if any, policies in there about how you're going to do any of this. It really is just generalised statements about the state of the country and where the various sectors are at.
And as I say, I think it's a serious statement of intent. And I see, and you should, I mean, and I'm sure you have looked, there is obviously at the back a programme of the various policies and statements that will be issued in the next 3, 6, 9 months. And one of them is the Action Plan for Jobs 2014, in which you will find the detail that is required. I mean, clearly the government is going to go on investing in education, investing in foreign direct investment, investing in areas of research and technology, providing support for businesses and so on, trying to make it more competitive, more competitive environment. And we have managed. We are a more competitive environment than we were. We also have the, you know, one of the most progressive tax systems in Europe, if not the most progressive. So those things are the things that have gone well that we need to continue doing. So I think it's very easy in this political climate to say this is all hollow, this is a waste of time. I'm darn sure that if it had been produced with lots and lots and lots and lots of detail, two or three of those details would be being picked over tonight and being criticised anyway. It's very easy to criticise.
OK, Dara Cleary, let me bring you in at this point. Isn't that fair enough from Susan O'Keefe? You know, the reality is 58,000 new jobs have been created over the last year. What's in this document is a restatement of policies and strategies that the government is already pursuing.
Look, we agree with the aspiration. We all sign up to the aspiration of 6% unemployment, etc. But the difficulty on this document is, Audrey, is firstly, it hasn't been prepared since Sunday. This document was flagged 6 months ago. Minister Noonan flagged it up, and various government people flagged this particular document as the government's vision of post-Troika Ireland. There is no vision. There's no societal vision. There's a series of economic figures that are very aspirational. The growth figures, we will have 0.3% growth this year, maybe slightly more, and it talks about going up to 3.9% growth. There are 66 pages. There are only 2 pages of actions in it, things that we can actually measure the plan against, things that we can say this time next year, well, this is what they've achieved this year. And some of those actions include, there's an aspiration in it, and I'll read directly, lower the cost of doing business in Ireland for all firms. You know, we all agree that's great. But how are you going to do that? What specific actions are you going to take in the next 12 months to do that? There is a commitment in it, again, to introduce an independent legal services regulatory authority. That commitment has been on the books for 2.5 years now. And when you go through it, there are a list of actions, many of which are heated up from previous government press statements, from previous government plans.
But were you expecting anything more?
I was. I genuinely was.
What were
thinking,
you expecting?
All right, this was flagged 6 months ago. So here we're going to get a plan to 2020 of where Ireland is going to be. Yes, job creation figures are there. And yes, the action plan for jobs will come in 2014. And the action plan for jobs is going to be completely changed to take account of the bigger figures. But where are we going to be educational wise? Where are we going to be health wise? You know, there's economic growth figures here, predictation. There's no downside. There's no account taken of the drag on our economic growth of the personal debt situation that we have. There is aspirational chapter in it about SMEs and about SME finance. There is a commitment in it to investigate the possibility of establishing an investment bank for SMEs. Yet that is a clear commitment in the programme for government that one will be established. So that commitment is watered down already. There is no recognition of the fact that various government schemes for SME finance this year, the government told us at the beginning of the year that they would invest 50 million in 3 different areas for financing for small and medium businesses. They've only actually got to 9 of that 50. Mm-hmm. There is a criticism of the European model in terms of the Europeans are not taking SME finance seriously. There is a call that they will work with the European Investment Bank, but there's no specific actions as to how we're going to do that.
Okay.
So given that it's 6 months in preparation, all we have is a collection of figures. There is no vision. For instance, you're going to be, you know, talking about domestic issues later. Mm-hmm. There's no sense of where the government sees itself in that. And I think it's a missed opportunity. What it is a list, basically, of reheated Troika leftovers.
OK, Cormac Lucy, what's your assessment of the document?
I think it's very aspirational. I think it's built on extraordinarily ambitious growth assumptions. And I think it's essentially a political document to provide the government with a smooth economic flight path in the run-up to the next general election. I think the government wants to communicate a narrative, excuse me, that austerity is over once the next budget has been got behind us. And that budget will be in the autumn of 2014. That will leave until the autumn of 2015 for the government to have a general election without collapsing economic growth objectives impinging directly on it. The government should be able to sustain a narrative that everything's fine until that point. But this document fails to address, as Derek Cleary has said, it fails to address the debt problems across the economy. It fails to address problems in the eurozone that could flame up again at any time. You know, loan growth in the eurozone is running at minus 2%. You have a former EU Commission president, Romano Prodi, banging the table saying Italy may have to leave the euro. That is extraordinary. And this document is, it's an electoral anaesthetic to communicate the notion to the electorate that the pain is over and that everything's fine, and Enda and Eamon are great lads, and just tick down there on the ballot paper and everything will be fine again.
Wow, I wish it was that easy, Cormac. And you know perfectly well that it isn't that easy, that absolutely no one in the country thinks for a single second that Enda and Eamon are going to walk out and everybody's going to say, hey, you're great boys. I think that that is to demean much of the spirit of this and much of the, if you like, building of a positive frame that you know perfectly well is extremely important for any country. Indeed, it's important for any business doing business to keep a positive frame. And it's important for any country to do the same. And certainly you go to Europe and ask anybody and they will say that the Irish government in the last 2.5 years has worked incredibly hard to restore a positive attitude about Ireland and about what has happened here. Yes, it's not perfect. You're absolutely right. There are plenty of things, plenty of work to be done. But that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be a small moment in which we say, yes, some of that has worked. We have got out of away from the bailout system. We are now a sovereign nation again. We will do business on our own terms. And I don't think there's any harm or any error in putting forward a document that aspires to better things in the future. And to call it a political document is naive in the extreme. This is politics. We are political parties in government. Yes, of course, there's a political aspect to this. There has to be. Why wouldn't there be? But to dismiss it simply as just something that will allow the boys to roll into the next general election is, as I say, naive and slightly ridiculous.
Well, I just think that in this year, the government expects us to hit 0.2% real GDP growth. Last year, we hit 0.2% real GDP growth. This document foresees us achieving 3.5% real GDP growth for several years. Mm-hmm. That is the mathematical device by which the government can say further austerity after the next budget will not be required. And that is the way to get to a glide path to the next election without difficult internal rows. And I believe... I don't disagree with that choice by the government in at one way, because what they're also doing is they're really putting it up to Europe. They're saying by saying this, by refusing the contingency line of credit, they're effectively saying, well, we did your plan. We were good boys and good girls and we got top marks and now we're out of the plan. And if that doesn't work, well, that's not our fault. That's your fault. So I think there's at a deeper realpolitik level, I agree with the choice they're making of riding naked out of the Troika deal and saying, you know, now we're on our own and we've got to make this work. And if this doesn't work, then it should raise, in the Irish electorate's eyes, fundamental questions regarding the capacity of the Troika elements that sent us into this programme.
Dara Cleary.
I think, you know, the difficulty is it is very ambitious growth figures. As Cormac has said, going from 0.2 this year to 3.5 in 2018, 2019, but there's no account taken of any downsides. And I think what yesterday's comments from Mario Draghi in relation to the bank stress tests, they're incredibly important. You know, if there is a difficulty still, not just with our banks, but with banks across Europe, they're going to impact on those great figures and the ability to do that. There's no account taken of that. There's no account taking, you know, we had in the middle of all the self-congratulation last week, there were very poor export figures for October and manufacturing figures and production figures. They're considerably, our export figures are 9% down year on year. Now, it might be a glitch, it might be due to demand issues, but if that becomes a trend, this document and the entire jobs policy of the government is based on an export-led recovery. We've had considerable job growth, a lot of it in areas that are vulnerable to change, agriculture and hospitality. But what we've also had, in 1 week in November, we had 1,000 job losses around the country in our pharmaceutical sector, on which many of the targets within this document are based. There's no account taken within the growth statistics of this. And the final, I think the final test for this document will be, what will the Fiscal Advisory Council say about it? Their job is to examine the government's various documents, and it will be interesting, and I don't know if Susan can share this information with us, what role had they in the preparation of this? Were they consulted? Or when will they issue an assessment of this particular document?
Susan O'Keefe.
I do think that one of the important aspects of this document is that it is something that the government can be held account on. You know, there are various things laid out here. I think that's one of the values of a document like this. I'm not aware of the Fiscal Council involvement or not. I do think, though, I listened very carefully to Sean Whelan on the news at six, and he was talking about, you know, looking at the predictions and seeing whether or not they were in line or out of line. And I quote, he said they were not wildly out of line with other people, including the ECB and the IMF. He did go on to say, and I think this is fair, and I think the government would accept this anyway, the further out you go from now, of course, it gets harder to predict. We all know that. But you still have to predict something. I don't see that you'd suddenly go, OK, after 2 years, let's not predict anything at all.
But
you
since
have
coming
to have
office,
some
Susan, you've
prediction.
Consistently revised downward your growth figures. So.
Until now. Until now.
The difficulties have been always...
And in fairness, IBEC, not part of the government, was predicting a higher growth rate than the government.
3% for next year.
Yes, of course, there is a difficulty. But I'm listening to other commentators saying, there is some value in these. The further out you go, maybe by the time you get to 2008, they will be revised again. That is part of the process.
But the Fiscal Advisory Council, one of the rationales for setting it up was precisely to review growth assumptions.
Yes.
And I checked on their website before coming on this programme, and there's no evidence from their website that they were consulted in any way on this. And I find that extraordinary from a government which went to great effort to set up the Fiscal Advisory Council, that they don't consult it on medium-term.
But they haven't
projections.
Even taken its advice on all occasions either.
No, and the most recent comment from the Fiscal Advisory Council was to say that the chances of the government missing the 3% target by 2015 had grown as a result of last October's budget from a third to a half.
Well, the 391,000 people that are on the live register at the moment are looking to this document to see, well, what's in it for me? Mm-hmm. If we get these growth figures, yes, you'll get to 8%. Unemployment, and there will be many of them taken off it. But they don't want to know if you're going to commit yourself to doing that, you commit yourself on the basis of certainty. You can't mess with people's hopes by hoping it'll do it. And if we have to revise it downwards, then we'll revise it downwards, because there are people out there tonight who aren't looking at 3% or 3.5%, they're looking at their job, mm-hmm. their household, and what's in it for them.
And we can actually talk to one of them now. We on the line is a man called Gordon Hyland. He's 50 years old. He's a technology specialist, and he's been looking for work for 5 years. Gordon, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good evening.
In this, at his news conference today, Eamon Gilmore said that the people who lost their jobs in this country over the past 5 years have to be ready and available to take these new jobs, these new 330,000 jobs that this government is going to help create over the next 7 years. Do you think it's you he's talking about?
No, I don't. I would say some big picture comments first. Clearly, from a press and an entertainment point of view, people in politics, if someone says left, the other person says right. If another person says up, you know, someone will say down. So I agree, without a question, you need a plan. No matter what the plan is, it's not going to be perfect. But I would argue that in the press it's not going to be solved, or even in politics it's not going to be solved. Now to your point about job creation and job growth. Practically all of that job creation and job growth is targeted toward the younger generation. and not necessarily the Irish generation. If you look at jobs that have been created in the past, let's say, 2 years, how many of them require, for instance, the person to speak Turkish, never mind French or potentially Estonian? By the way, and I have no problem for people coming from other parts of the world to work in Ireland, but I'm saying that one has to be realistic about the jobs that are being created, and they're targeted toward young, cheaper people and service-type functions, which in general don't support, don't support the present lifestyle or the previous lifestyle of those who are out of work.
Mm. So is it your view, Gordon, that there will be a whole generation of people who are unemployed at the moment and who will never work again?
It's not my view that there will be. There factually is. If one looks at unemployment numbers, and of course the document, like most documents from any government, doesn't actually quote what I would term the real numbers. As the IMF once observed, they reckon the real number of unemployed in the country is between 21 and 23%. It's nothing between 13 and 14%. And then if you look at the type of people who are unemployed from an age spectrum, of course, everybody talks about the younger generations coming out of university and even some who haven't got university, but people more or less in their early 20s and under 30. And I'll say it in the following way. I don't have huge amounts of sympathy for them because they can always get on an aeroplane and leave and go to countries like Canada and Australia where they will get a visa. And then people in Ireland will start complaining about emigration and so on. And I would argue I've lived and worked in 7 countries in the world in my career, that will be the best thing that ever happened to them in life. However, for the other end of the curve, the people who've been hit most by the economic downturn, whether they're Irish only or Irish specific, but if you look at all the countries in the world from the United States through Europe, so on, the worst hit are those in their 40s and 50s because they're not so mobile. And even if they were mobile, there aren't the jobs for them. It's a pyramid. Mm-hmm. Jobs are created in a pyramid. You don't need so many CEOs, and you know, you simply need more people to, you know, pick up the garbage or dig up the roads, or as most of the jobs are created in the middle of that spectrum, high-tech or biopharma jobs at, you know, let's say 30 years and younger, fresh PhDs, et cetera, et cetera.
So your argument is that, take architects, for example, that
yes,
despite what has been announced today and the aims and the aspirations and the ambitions, that by the time all of this is over, the vast majority of architects will still be unemployed.
That's correct, yes. And if they are employed, it won't be as architects anymore. Now, it would be good for governments, and this is not, I would say, let's say, the subject of just political football, which these things usually are in this country. But this, there's a humanitarian crisis, and it's not me who says it's actually the American ambassador to the Union, going on throughout Europe. You have in Ireland, in Spain, in Portugal, wherever, you have a division of the labor force into those who are more or less insecure jobs with good pensions. Relative, everything's relative at one end of the spectrum. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have those who are simply hopping around looking for any type of job and more or less getting temporary contracts. Mm-hmm. Look at all the recent government jobs that have been advertised, and there are not that many of them, so it's easy to look at them. None of them are permanent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's touted as a great thing, of course, to the general public. We're cracking down on high salaries in the public service, etc. Rest assured, they're not that high, and I'm not a public servant, never was. But it's different for the person who actually gets that job. You know, they have a 3-year contract, and let's say for sake of argument, they're 45. So for the next 3 years, they're worried: am I going to get another contract?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm 48, and if I don't have another contract, what am I going to do?
Okay.
And the acid test is: bring that contract to a bank and see if they'll lend you money.
Yeah.
Of course they won't.
Gordon, stay on the line if you would. I'd like to get the reaction from our guests here in the studio to what you're saying. Susan O'Keefe, does Gordon have a point there about, you know, the types of people that your government is talking about creating these jobs for between now and the end of the decade?
I think part of the difficulty always is that, particularly in a country like Ireland, where we have such a high number of young people, you know, the number of young people is probably higher in Ireland than anywhere else. And the evidence shows that if you don't try to get young people into jobs at an early point, they then drift into a pattern of unemployment, and then it's harder to get them out of that. And it's to try to avoid that is retraining or offering job bridge schemes and so on, and trying to encourage people as they leave university and leave training to find work and creating jobs there. And of course, yes, companies are looking always. They will do. That's the market economy for people who will perhaps do it at 40,000 a year instead of 60,000 a year.
But people like Gordon, yes, and so many thousands of others who are 40 plus and who've been out of work, are they essentially written off?
Well, I don't believe they're written off. I think it's harder. And Gordon, I don't know what it's like not to have a job at this time. So I can't pretend that I do. But I do appreciate that at a point like that, when you're looking for work and you have a huge number of skills, it's very difficult to believe that no one has a place for you because you have so much to offer. Because obviously of your experience. So that's always going to be very difficult. There's always going to be. And at the point where thousands of people lost their jobs at the same time in the last 4 to 5 years, yes, there is a logjam. I don't think, though, that this, I don't see, and I've never heard anybody sort of say, well, we're actually going to write off the people over 40. And certainly when I talk to companies that are hiring people, they're always saying that they're also looking for high value jobs, by which they usually mean people with some experience and not the sort of green guys coming out that need to actually to be trained to work in an industry.
Cormac, what's your view on that?
Well, I think Gordon made a very important point, this division of society between those who have secure and insecure jobs. And to be quite honest, I think the proportion that have secure jobs is actually very small. Mm. And we have an awful lot of insecurity across society at every level. And part of this, I think, is a sort of a long-run effect of globalisation. And we're all in competition with everybody else. Whereas 30, 40 years ago, there were large areas which were protected and sheltered, and people had much greater security as a result. I've had to switch jobs and careers quite a number of times in my life, and most recently when my political advice to Michael McDougall was so good that he lost a seat and thus I lost my job as his advisor. So it is tough and it's lonely, and you know, there's a measure to which people have to be flexible, but there's a central problem at the minute, which is there's a complete lack of demand, and no matter how flexible the unemployed are right now, there are insufficient jobs for them to satisfy them all. And that's why I think we need to, you know, one of the disappointments for me of this document that we're talking about is it doesn't face up to the hard strategic choices on tax, on welfare, on pensions and on the euro. And instead it's aspirational, but you know, we're all in favour of motherhood and apple pie. That really doesn't get us very far.
Dara, you were shaking your head there when I was asking Susan, are people over the age of 40 written off?
I think in many companies' eyes they are, but they shouldn't be. And actually my colleague Senator Mary White has done a lot of work and published research in this whole area of getting older people involved in the workforce. Many employers have said that they would love, if they could, because they bring experience, as everybody said, they bring experience, you know, of life to the position as well. But there needs to be far more encouragement given. But I think Susan does make the point. It is incredibly important. There are many people in their 40s whose family are also unemployed. Mm. Because we, you know, and we need to break that cycle. And it's important that the investment is put in at breaking the link early on so that you don't end up full-time unemployed. But it is a frustration in terms of older people is that there's €112 million sitting in the National Training Fund that could be used on activation programs for people like Gordon, incredibly skilled, yet there is demand for skills there that can't be reached at any time in this country at the moment. There's 5,500 vacancies in our tech sector. Now, some of them are in the area that Gordon mentioned in terms of having native language skills. And that is always going to be a challenge. But there is money available if the ambition was there in terms of activation to skill people up for where the demand is and where the vacancies are. And I think we need to do a lot of work in the new employment service, Intreo, need to do a lot of work and focus on older unemployed people to make sure that they're not forgotten about.
Gordon, just a final word to you. I mean, where are the obstacles that you're coming up against? As we said, you're a technology specialist. You've worked with some of the biggest and leading technology companies in the world. Where are the obstacles to you getting a job?
I can say many things, and I would like to address some of the points raised as well. So let me answer your question first, and then if I may, go to some of the other points. Okay, very frankly, companies, and I'm a big company guy, and I'm also an entrepreneur as well as an intrapreneur, et cetera, et cetera. I've got significantly more than 20 years experience in the tech industry globally at high levels as well. And I'm qualified in multiple disciplines, including finance and law. No ANCO or whatever it's called these days, FOSS or whatever training course is going to help people like me, period. They're just a waste of money. Never mind time and so on. Companies say they want, for instance, entrepreneurial people. They don't. They want soldiers. And I'm speaking from a vice president level, having been one. So let's get that one clear. Secondly, the type of skill sets people are looking for, I remember being in an innovation conference in this country, and there was this the subject came up of, let's say, for sake of argument, 5,000 unfilled vacancies in the tech sector, and they're typically software jobs, and they have certain skill sets, you know, C++ or whatever the soup du jour of languages these days is. So you can already guess from my my use of language what I think of that. It is total crap. It's very simply those companies, if they wanted to fill those vacancies and offered proper salaries, those jobs would be filled within 1 month,
okay. Period.
You would have people coming from Latin America if that's what it took, but they would be filled. Now, then various comments about, you know, cutting cloth to measure or, again, whatever the phrase of the day is, it's great when one is speaking theoretically, and theoretically means about someone else, including your neighbor, taking pay cut. You know, would you do the same job you have for 50% less money? Would you do it for 65% less? This is the type of discussions I've been having, not just here, but all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a structural problem, not just in Ireland, and every country has its own peculiarities, but in the United States, in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe, and even parts of Asia,
okay. Although
it's less of a problem there. Look at it this way. This is the Great Recession is a euphemism. In parts of the world, it's been a depression, a technical depression, minus 10% GDP in the space of 1 year. So, you know, people are avoiding saying it like it is. It took 25 years and a world war to recover, for the stock markets to recover from that. So there's no quick fix. But if society doesn't recognize the problem in the first case, and it doesn't talk about it, and it is a problem, it really is, not just in Ireland, it's all over Europe and the United States. It first has to recognize it as a problem and then look at practical ways of dealing with it. So do you think someone in their 40s who effectively doesn't work for the rest of their life is free on society? They're not going to be able to survive for many years burning through all their savings.
Okay. Gordon,
that's a state burden.
Look, we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us tonight, and thank you very much indeed. That's Gordon Hyland there, who is a technology specialist and who has been looking for work for 5 years, like many, many other people in this country. So just to wind this discussion up, I suppose, restoring the 330,000 jobs lost during the past 5 years, full employment by 2020. Realistic, Susan?
Well, I suppose I've always been a believer in the idea of full employment. I've never been convinced that we'll arrive at it. What I do see is that jobs are being created and that we'll have to work at creating more of them. So I'm probably a bit suspicious of full employment, but I certainly believe that things are improving slowly, slowly, and I would like to see them continue to improve slowly. I don't want to see a great big spike because we know spikes don't work.
Briefly, Cormac.
I think we'll make progress towards the goal without reaching it. But a substantial portion of that progress will come as a result of changes in the incentives facing the unemployed rather than from the economic growth, which we would rather drive the whole thing.
And Dara?
Realistic, absolutely not on the basis of this document. And I think we need to do a lot more to encourage people to set up their own business, to become their own employer. There's, again, very little to encourage people to be their own boss. And there are so many opportunities. This plan doesn't contain any.
OK, well, at this point, Dara, you're leaving us, as are you, Cormac. Susan, you're staying with us for the next part of the discussion. Thank you both very much indeed. It's 25 to 11. You're listening to Late Debate. As Christmas draws closer, many people are looking forward to the celebrations, but some people are dreading it for various reasons, one being the excessive consumption of alcohol and the violence which sometimes follows. The most recent figures show that almost 8,000 women and over 3,000 children sought refuge from domestic violence in 2011. Joining me now to discuss violence against women at home and in wider society are Ellen O'Malley Dunlop, who is Chief Executive of the Rape Crisis Centre, Kitty Holland, Social Affairs Correspondent with the Irish Times, Labour Senator Susan O'Keefe is staying with us, and from Brussels we'll be joined by Mary Collins, who is Policy Officer with the European Women's Lobby. I want to play first, though, this clip to illustrate the type of attitude that exists in some quarters towards hitting women. Back in 2009, Barbara Walters interviewed the former Bond star Sean Connery, and she reminded him of things he had once said about violence against women.
You did an interview in which you said, it's not the worst thing to slap a woman now and then. As I remember, you said you don't do it with a clenched fist, it's better to do it with an open hand.
Mm.
Yeah, remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't love that.
I haven't changed my opinion.
You haven't?
No, not at all.
You think it's good to slap a woman?
No, I don't think it's good.
You don't think it's bad?
I don't think it's that bad. I think that it depends entirely on the circumstances and if it merits it. Yeah.
What would merit it?
Well, if you have tried everything else, and women are pretty good at this, that they can't leave it alone. Yeah? They don't want to have the last word, and you give them the last word, but they're not happy with the last word. They want to say it again and get into a really provocative situation. Then I think it's absolutely right.
And that was Sean Connery talking back in 2009. Ellen O'Malley Dunlop, what do you think when you hear that?
It's absolutely shocking. I can't believe that somebody who is a role model or can be a role model for so many men is saying such shocking things. To think, I mean, it absolutely, I think, dehumanises the woman. And that is so unacceptable. I used to like Sean Connery,
and yet
I'm afraid plummeted.
It's an attitude, though, that obviously exists, Kitty, given the numbers of women who suffer from domestic violence.
Well, yes, I've never heard that clip before. But as Ellen Dunlop says there, it's almost as if he's talking about trying to train a dog or something. It's absolutely appalling. But yes, I mean, it's maybe he's dared to express what is out there in society. And what, I mean, this was only in 2009, quite a recent outpouring from Sean Connery. But there is certainly an attitude that's very strong in Irish society and possibly in Scottish and British society, that that women are somehow the property of their men, particularly once they get married, that they have made their bed and they must lie in it if they suffer any kind of violence or abuse or emotional or violent abuse. So it's shocking, but perhaps we should step back and say, is this something that's out there and we need to actually really think quite deeply about?
What do you think, Susan?
I mean, clearly Sean Connery was thinking he was James Bond still in that clip. And like the others, I hadn't heard it before and it is shocking. I think it has a use, though, because it does allow us. He has nailed what it is that some men believe is the appropriate way to behave. And he's nailed it there. And actually, we need to keep nailing it and keep using that and keep reminding people that's actually what we're talking about. And I suppose Safe Ireland, you know, the organisation that is the umbrella for domestic violence services in Ireland, they have a campaign called Man Up, which is specifically calling on men who are decent and who, as they say themselves, the majority of men are decent, mm-hmm. who care for women, who love women, who look after women and children, calling on them to stand up and say, we want zero tolerance for this kind of male behaviour. And in fact, in their own document, in their own literature, they talk about exactly that kind of man. You know, I manage her money. I have an eye for the sort of clothes she should wear. But, you know, if she disrespects me, I come down strong. That's what any man would do, isn't it? Well, no, it isn't. So I think that the Man Up campaign that they're running is a very good one, because it changes the emphasis away, and is actually exactly what Sean Connery is talking about. And it's a campaign that has been running now during this year. And the Taoiseach was involved earlier on this year, and I have pledged and am pledging here that we will ask every member, every male member of the Oireachtas in January to sign up for Man Up. And I've asked the Taoiseach today, and he has agreed to do that. And in a way, that is part of it, keeping talking about the way in which men have to take a role in this as well, because otherwise we're not going to change it. But it's one piece of a very big jigsaw.
Yes, and in this case of sexual violence, there's Don't Be That Guy, which is, again, another awareness-raising programme that we've been supporting. And it actually was initiated first and foremost by the Union of Students of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And it's been fantastic. But as I was talking to Kitty earlier, the Union of Students of Ireland recently had a piece of research that they published called Say Something. And it was quite shocking that a lot of the young women who were victims of sexual violence didn't realise it was a crime, and didn't either know of the services that were there. So I want to say that there is a 24-hour helpline for sexual violence, and it's 1-800-77-88-88. And if anybody needs to call it, there is always a trained person at the end of the line.
What is your explanation, Ellen? I mean, can you attempt to get inside the mindset of a man who beats up a woman?
It's very difficult. I think there's a sense of entitlement that can, you know, that there's an attitude that men are entitled to women. And I think so often, particularly nowadays, with social media, young men learning about relationships through the internet and through pornography, starting off with soft, whatever soft pornography is, I don't know, but going on to hardcore pornography. And it's as if they become desensitized. And they treat the woman as an object. So, but they're also treating themselves as an object, and it is there is no sense of real of relationships. So, in schools, I think we need to ensure that the programs, the SPHE program in particular in secondary schools, is not being delivered. And there was, again, research shown, the inspectorates did a piece of research, and this SPHE program is not being taught in
what
schools.
What is that, though? Just
it's the sexual, social personal, and health education.
Okay.
So it's an opportunity where young people in groups can talk about relationships, can talk about the age of consent, can learn about their own body. And the Rape Crisis Centre have developed Body Right, which is again a programme to follow on from that. And it's really, it's getting young people, facilitating them, talking about relationships, and not just the physical, but what it means to be in a relationship, mm-hmm. what the age of consent is. It's 17, and I know there's a discussion to bring that down, and we would certainly not support that.
You wouldn't support
that?
We
would definitely not support.
Why not?
Because we believe that the age of consent should be kept at 17. If anything, it should be brought up to 18, where that's when young people can vote. But there are some young people who are, I know, they're having sexual relationships much younger, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean they're ready for it.
But doesn't mean they should be criminalised?
I think they should not be criminalised. I think in terms of, there's a difference between exploratory sexual relationship between young people and relationships where they're being coerced, mm-hmm. and there's a very fine line, mm-hmm. and I think we need to ensure that young people have got the information, and that they're hearing it from the right sources, and not having it through peer pressure.
I want to bring it back to violence against women. And I suppose I'll bring in Mary Collins, who is policy officer with the European Women's Lobby at this point. Mary is joining us this
Hello.
Evening from Brussels, and you're very welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
I was saying in my introduction, you know, that Christmas is a time when many people dread this time of year because of the violence which sometimes accompanies the excessive consumption of alcohol and even without alcohol being involved. Is it worse at this time of the year for many women at home?
Well, I think, first of all, just to come back to what Sean Connery was saying, I think unfortunately he was revealing what is a reality in many European societies, is that violence against women is tolerated and it's accepted. And then there are excuses that there's this time of year, that there's alcohol and everything else. But I think the bottom line is that we're still living in a society today where we tolerate violence, and we think that men's domination over women is actually acceptable. And that's something that we really have to change. And it's time to change that and to put pressure on that. And perhaps this time of the year is a good opportunity to put these issues on the political agenda and to say that violence against women is something that happens right throughout the year, and that it's not only in times of, you know, when there are festivities and when there's drink and everything else. That's an excuse, actually. Mm-hmm. Violence against women is something that is absolutely tolerated in our societies. Our mentalities haven't changed. We still believe that it's something that men do to women, and that it's something that is acceptable, and that's something that we really and truly have to change.
Do you agree with that, Kitty? I mean, that in many ways, you know, where hitting a child is no longer in any way acceptable, is hitting a woman still acceptable?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to make that point that we have, you know, reached a point in society where, you know, to beat up a child or to abuse them or to rape them is absolutely unacceptable, but it's somehow it's tolerable when it's a woman. And I think it comes back to that kind of still quite sexist, judgmental attitude to women who are in these situations, that in some ways they're the property of the man, that the man is entitled to inflict this on them, that it's their fault, that they provoked them, that they're that the man is under pressure, that they need to put up with it, that they need to bear with it for the sake of the children. I mean, these hugely complex situations that give rise to domestic violence. But, I mean, the bottom line has to be it is never, ever acceptable to commit a violent crime against a woman, whether that's in a home, on the street, in a pub, anywhere. It's not acceptable. And women need to be empowered to recognise that it's unacceptable to be treated like that. I mean, it's wonderful that there are these campaigns aimed at the men, saying that they, you know, need to recognise that it's not acceptable behaviour on their part. But women also need to be empowered to recognise it's not acceptable to be treated like that. And I mean, I've interviewed I've interviewed a lot of women over the years who have escaped these situations. And what comes through all the time is how they were, you know, really charmed and fall for these charming men. And there are niggling signs at the beginning, like that they would get, you know, explosively angry for silly reasons, like they might talk to another man. But the man would gradually kind of break them down and, you know, undermine their confidence, put them down in front of their friends, tell them they're being oversensitive, start to control their finances, want to know where they're going, just really begin to make them feel really worthless. And often it's when the men start actually treating the children badly that is when the women will recognise, actually, this he's now doing it to my kids, and that's not acceptable. But they'll put up with it themselves. And women need to be empowered to say, to recognise, this shouldn't be happening to me, and I need to seek help, and I'm entitled to help.
Susan?
I agree with Kitty. Women do need to be empowered. I suppose the thing about the empowering of men is the hope that men who are being violent towards women might listen to other men, where they will not and have not ever listened to women. And that the idea, I suppose, behind Man Up is that the large majority of men in our society who are absolutely terrific when it comes to women, that their voice would be lifted up and they would have a say, and they would try to persuade the men to listen to them, because they're clearly not listening to us, let's face it. I mean, the problem is, you know, we're talking about thousands of women and their children, not just in Ireland, but across the world. And indeed, we know that many of those women never come forward. So while we know we have figures of thousands who have reported violence, there are many, many more who do not. And the interesting thing is that some of the research in the UK shows that it is not now the recognised thing about anger management. It's actually not anger management is the big problem in relation to the men themselves. It's more about their attitudes and more about their desire to control people and particularly women. And so in their courses to support men to stop violence, that's what they concentrate on. In Ireland, we have a couple of courses available for men, a couple of support courses available for men, not across the country. They haven't been evaluated yet. Some of them are still depending just on the anger management aspect. So there's a huge piece of work to be done in relation to research as to how those models can be put into place. Because if there's nothing there to support those men, when they need it, to try to unlearn that behaviour, to try to learn a better way. We are never going to get to the bottom of it. We're never going to look at the causes and try to help men. And I'm sure that there are women listening saying, never mind the men, I'm a victim. But we need to help. I'm not at all arguing that we shouldn't help women, and it is mostly women who've been the victims of this. But we also absolutely need to stand up and say men need that help too, and they need to unlearn that behaviour. And it can be unlearned, but it's an investment, but it's just completely ignored.
Ellen, Owen has texted to say, what absolute drivel. I know of nobody who believes that violence against women is acceptable. It's notable that violence by women against men is ignored. What do you say to that?
I don't think that's the case. We know from research, of course, there are some men who are victims of violence, but it's a tiny minority in comparison to the numbers of women who are victims of violence against who are victims themselves of violence. I think one of the things we need to talk to our politicians about, I think the thing that might make them sit up is the cost, the economic cost of violence against women. And there was a piece of research done by the United Nations and an in-depth study across 13 countries. And the cost of violence, domestic violence alone, over 13 countries, including the UK and the United States, was $15 billion per year. And that translates in Ireland to $2.2 billion per year. That's domestic violence alone. Now, I think that is something that may make our politicians sit up and take note. And also they said, but because the costs of violence against women are so widespread throughout a whole society, it is always the case, and always the case, that a small amount of money spent on effective programmes will lead to a much larger saving in total costs in the future.
Mm. So, Kitty, do many of these cases, you say that, you know, during your time as a journalist with the Irish Times, you've talked to many women. Do many of them come to court? Are there many convictions against men?
Very few come to court. Ellen was particularly with the marital rape. I think we've had one case come to court since 30 years, you know. So very few. I mean, I suppose the women just want to get away from the situation. And you know, and these are the women who are driven to a point where they want to, you know, make the move to escape from that situation. I mean, one of the startling figures is that while 7,500 women on average a year access domestic violence services, that's only 10%. So there's 75,000 women a year are affected by this, and their children, obviously, then. And it's a cycle. I mean, I've spoken to a number of women who have whose mothers who were in domestic violence situations, and indeed their fathers, their husbands, as children, were in domestic homes where there's domestic violence. So it's a pattern that repeats itself. And, you know, it's something that really needs to be, you know, stopped and nipped in the bud is the wrong term. But it's, you know, that it needs to be addressed because it is something that goes on and on.
I think as politicians, we have a huge responsibility. Yeah. I mean, it's an issue that I spend some time, because I absolutely believe that part of this is legislative, part of it is putting, you know, more money into it. But it is also a society responsibility. Mm-hmm. There are two halves to this. Mm-hmm. And I have sat in various studios over the last 2 to 3 years, and indeed as a journalist, told stories about women, particularly pregnant women, being a very particular subgroup of women who attract a very violent response from some men. And I find I'm still sitting here, and I dearly wish that we could, we do need to do more. And I will continue to do my piece, but we don't seem to be able to make any breakthrough. And I don't know whether that would be your view too. We seem to be still in this place where we know what the problem is, we can quantify it, and Safe Ireland have done that and others have done it, and we just don't seem to be able to punch through and make it
Mary
a big
Collins
difference.
In Brussels, yeah. Would it make a big difference if this government signed the Istanbul Convention?
Absolutely, and that's what we absolutely need.
Just explain very briefly what that is.
Leadership. Okay, so the Council of Europe Convention, it's on the prevention and combating violence against women and domestic violence.
Okay.
So it's called the Istanbul Convention.
And it needs two more signatories to ratify it.
Exactly. So once 10 countries have ratified it, it will become an all-encompassing effective tool. For the moment, there are 8 countries. And of those 8 countries, there are only 3 EU member state countries, namely Austria, Italy and Poland. Now, Ireland hasn't signed and hasn't ratified. And there's really no reason why Ireland shouldn't do so, because, in fact, the legislation, because I should first of all say that in terms of particularly sexual violence and rape, it is a crime in all countries. And the definition of rape in the Irish legislation is quite close to the Council of Europe's mm-hmm. convention, so there is really no reason why it shouldn't ratify the convention. Because we at the European Women's Lobby, we carried out a barometer earlier this year on the particular issue of rape, and what we saw was that only between 2 and 10% of rapes are reported to the police every year, which is very, very low, and which obviously calls into question the whole issue and also looks at the seriousness of the problems. And when we look at the reasons why women don't report rape, obviously it's because there's a real risk of being re-victimised. They're not, believed when mm-hmm. they actually report rapes. And also their whole life history, including their own sexual history, is put into question as well. So it's a real serious violation of women's rights and of women's bodily integrity.
Okay,
as well.
So Susan O'Keefe, when you say that you're working hard at this, and very few people, I'm sure, would doubt that, but there is something this government could do to signal how serious it is about the issue.
Absolutely, and I completely support Mary's remarks in relation to the Istanbul Convention, and I will, continue to press myself for that to be signed.
Is there a reason why it hasn't, or...?
I don't know the reason.
This is where cutbacks are really hurting us. Mm-hmm. There's a National Steering Committee on Violence Against Women which has been pushing for this, and that has been cut back from 4 meetings a year to 2 meetings, and that is just totally unacceptable. Mm-hmm. We have been making huge strides really in this area. But in terms of the Istanbul Convention, what we've been told is that there's a constitutional block to us signing it at the moment, and it's to do with property rights. And to be honest with you, I don't like the rape and sexual violence piece. Yes, is straightforward enough, but it's to do with domestic violence and property rights.
Well, one of the pieces I'm trying to work with the Minister for Housing, John O'Sullivan, is in relation to that if a woman, is a part owner of a property, she then has to leave because she has been the victim of violence. She then is not eligible for any support, really, because she's the part owner of a house with the partner.
Yes.
So and the heads of the new housing bill will come very soon. There will be a debate about it in January, February. I have committed, and I have already talked to the Minister. I will go on talking to her, and I'm very much that particular piece would be changed, and it would mm-hmm. specify domestic violence, that women who find themselves in that position, that property mm-hmm. situation
Isn't
would
it
change.
Shocking that the victim of the crime has to leave the home while the criminal sits
and
pretty
then can't
in the
get in, and then can't get anything?
And that speaks
left.
To the sexism in our society,
and the
which
patriarchal
says it's her fault. She must leave.
But it's not,
she provoked him.
And it's not just the woman, it's the children as well.
Who lose their home and their bedroom and their toys and their friends and where they go to school.
And on one day, 537 women, recorded as having reported a need. That's, if you like, that's on one day in Ireland, on a snapshot. That's more than one woman for every day in the year. Mm. Yes, this is a very, very serious problem.
But Ellen, signing a convention is not going to change attitudes, is it?
No.
Well, it's part of it, as Susan said. It's part of the answer. And in relation to sexual violence in Ireland, 1 in 10 report the crime, and of the 1 in 10, only 7% of that one get to court. Now, when they get to court, there's a high conviction rate, but it's very, very difficult. And those victims who stay the course of the criminal justice system are doing all of society a service, because the perpetrators of those, you know, who are convicted are taken out of society and are being punished. But the majority of perpetrators are committing these crimes with impunity.
Can I just say that signing the convention would send out a loud message from the state that this is unacceptable.
Yeah. Look, thank you all very much indeed. I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you, Ellen O'Malley Dunlop, Kitty Holland, Susan O'Keefe and Mary Collins. Tomorrow on the programme, we'll be debating the health service plan with a panel of experts, who join us for that, 10 o'clock, usual time. Until then, from all the team, good night.
The Late Debate, presented by Audrey Carville, was produced by Donal O'Herlihy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney, the researcher Nicolette Lennox, and sound supervision tonight was by Pather Carney.